today on the Beginner Photography Podcast.
But if we, as photographers, want to really instill interesting elements into our images, we have to do things like, you know, put our hand up really high to photograph shooting down, or to get really low and to shoot from a lower perspective, which actually empowers our primary subject. So if it's a person, it makes them appear grander and more important. And that's a good thing.
Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, where each week we interview the world's most interesting photographers to learn what it really takes to capture beautiful images and compelling stories so that you can start to do the same. Today, we have an interview from the Beginner Photography Podcast Vault. You know, after years of interviewing world-class photographers, we have built up an incredibly rich library of photography tips and tricks that guests share to help you to get better at capturing amazing images. Now, with new listeners finding the show every day, these Rewind interviews allow new listeners to discover those gold nuggets of information of the past, and also allow longtime listeners to revisit and hear an interview with fresh ears and more hands-on experience to draw from. Well, in today's Beginner Photography Podcast Rewind, we are hearing from travel photographer Mark Hemmings. When I interviewed him back in episode 141, where he shared all about taking better vacation photos. So in this one, we covered all from, you know, what gear you should bring and not bring, the types of photos that you should be taking, and the simple compositional elements that will really elevate the quality of your photos for your upcoming trip. So with that, let's go ahead and get on into today's interview. Today's guest is Mark Hemmings, a professional travel photographer who, according to his website, over the next 12 months is scheduled to visit 5 different continents, which is crazy. And today I'm really excited to chat and find out how we can be taking better photos of our own travels. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure, Raymond. And thank you for inviting me. And I always love to be able to communicate my first love with regards to my hobby and my career, and to share as much of my information to the public as possible.
Well, if I can, if I've picked up one thing through watching some of your YouTube videos, it's definitely that you love to share information. So I know that this is going to be a great podcast. But before you kind of got to this point, right, where you travel the world and you take photos, you teach others how to take photos while they're on their travels, how did you get your start in photography?
Yeah, so the start for me was fairly unique, in that when I graduated from my university here in Eastern Canada called University of New Brunswick, about a half year or a year later, I got an interesting job to become an ESL, that's English as a Second Language student recruiter. And myself and a bunch of others who were set up as a team were sent to Asia and other countries. And our job was to bring students to Eastern Canada to learn English for this university program. And I was in Japan for 5 weeks. And it was really a fascinating experience being in that country. And I learned very quickly that my skill set was definitely not student recruiting. In fact, I don't think that I did any good at all. No students came. However, I did realize that for the first time, and this was 1 year after graduating university, that I was actually fairly good at taking pictures. And my grandfather gave me his old Nikon camera. And if I recall, it was called a Nikon EM. And it was one of the first, I think, a classic film camera, but it also allowed aperture priority, which was very helpful. And of course, back then it was slide film. And I really learned the hard way to get proper exposure, because every picture was a single dollar. And for me, being a young fellow with not too much money, that dollar had to go a long way. So one picture, and I had to get the exposure right. That was the first introduction to my career as a photographer. Then after that, I started to work in the movie industry as a photographer. A good friend of mine said, "Hey, Mark, there's a Hollywood movie here working in town, and we just need to get someone who knows how to use a camera." So that was my first job. And then from the movie industry, it branched out into commercial photography, advertising photography, and then the travel photography, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Of course, of course. So, wow, that was quite a journey. I kind of want to unpack that a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you went on this trip to Japan to recruit students to come back to Canada. And then it sounded like you said after you had graduated is when you got your camera. So was that trip to Japan kind of you didn't have a camera at that point, correct?
No. In fact, I asked my grandfather if I could borrow his Nikon. He gave it to me just for that trip. And I had about a week or two to figure out the knobs and dials. What are these numbers on
a
the
whole
lenses?
Week.
What's the number on the shutter? And I have no idea. And the hard part is that I knew I wanted to shoot slide film because my parents, growing up, we would always have fun looking at slideshows projected on the wall or on a screen. So I said, I think I really want to jump in with slide film. And I didn't realize how hard slide film is compared to negatives, because in negatives, you take them to the shop and they in the lab can correct for any type of exposure problems. Not so with slide film. Slide film, you have to be dead accurate. And I learned the lesson the hard way.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. So you got back. You realize you're like, okay, I have an idea of what this camera can do. I know that I obviously have to nail exposure. So how did you, was there anything outside of just practice that you used to be your primary source of photography education?
Yes. Back then we didn't have online education, of course. This was two decades ago, 1997. And so what I did was I got as many photo magazines as possible. And in Canada, we had and still do a really good one called Photo Life, which I definitely recommend. Outdoor Photographer from the States, and a whole bunch of other photo magazines, some international ones. And I would just consume them like food, as many magazines as possible. And then when I started to really get into portraiture and fashion, I would just consume fashion magazines. This is all I had. I didn't have any training. I studied philosophy. That was my major in university, and I graduated with it because I assumed that I would just become a university professor in philosophy. So I didn't want to go back to school for photography because I was married, newly married, and I just wanted to get right into photography and make money. So the magazines were the things that kept me going and helped me craft the style that I have.
Mm-hmm. Geez. So in 97, I barely remember 97. 97, I was 9 years old in 97.
Yes.
We just got our first computer, and it was still many years until we had got our first digital camera or even like video camera. I had somewhere very specific I was going with that question, and then I got sidetracked thinking about that little old computer that I hated so much. So when it comes time to picking up the camera and you're shooting with slides, you're out there, you're getting that experience. What sorts of photography were you pursuing? Obviously, you said motion pictures, but then when did that love of photography and travel merge together?
Yes. So when I was in Japan, it was I went into a special place called Nagano, and a lot of people recognize Nagano because the Olympics were there, the Winter Olympics in the 90s. And nature, back then, it was all nature and all landscapes, and that was the prize. And I absolutely loved it. So when I got back, and it was time to switch gears into learning how the movie industry works with regards to photography. So, for example, that would be I would be sent out by the producers to location scout for any place that's in the script. So if the script said creepy old house, I needed to go find that in my own city. And, of course, that the job also included photographing the actors. So back then, we still had film, and I had to buy what's called a blimp, which is a soundproof covering that covered my Nikon cameras. And man, that was a hassle. It's so nice now that we have silent, the Fujifilm having the ability to shoot silently. However, the transitions that I've gone through have been very interesting because I've almost touched on every genre of photography. I know you do a lot of weddings. Mm-hmm. I did try a few weddings in the late 90s, and I realized that it takes a very, it takes a lot of, what would you say, grace to deal with, you know, the normal scenarios of mothers-in-laws and people who are, have really, they really know what they want, and there's very little flexibility. And I realized my personality is such that I don't think that this is going to be sustainable, because you need to have a really, you need to be an actor. And I'm sure you would agree, in the sense that your emotions have to be on, you need to be up. And I realized that I just wasn't so good at this. So then I realized that, well, the movie industry thing's going well, but then we had a problem where the tax credits from our government dried up. So the movie industry dried up. No longer were Hollywood movie shoots or New York shoots coming up here to Canada because the tax breaks were gone. So what's left? Well, I started into commercial photography. So that would be working for the local, you know, any local company that needs advertising. We have a lot of industry here in the East Coast. So I'd be working for oil companies, nuclear power plants, all these big companies. And I must say that those worked out well for helping me get, you know, bring in the money to buy new gear and to support my young family.
Yeah. Geez. So when was it that you decided to make that jump to focus more on travels?
Yeah. So that would be in 2004. And my brother, Greg Hemmings, who is one of my greatest influencers, he's younger than me, actually, he said, Mark, I have a really sort of interesting scenario. I've been asked to go to South Korea to teach filmmaking, because my brother's a filmmaker, to teach filmmaking at a South Korean film academy. But my friend's getting married at the same date. So he said, would you like to take my place? And I said, let me think about that. Yes.
Yeah. Didn't take long, did it?
That's right. So I was off to South Korea. I met some amazing people there, especially some really good friends from Hungary. And the Hungarian friends that I met, they said, hey, Mark, we're doing a film workshop and photo workshop in Hungary next year. Would you like to come as a guest instructor? And I said, yes. So that was the initiation of me combining photography with travel. And then the year later, I said, well, why don't I do my own workshop in Japan? Because I had experience. I've been there twice before. So I started one in Japan. And that was in 2005, I think. And since then, I've been doing them every single year.
I love it. I love it. Obviously, looking at your website, you've been to various exotic locations, some very tropical locations. And I know that you're doing a cruise workshop, which sounds really cool because my family is this fall, we're going on a cruise together. Okay. So it's my family. It's my wife's family. It's my parents. So it's going to be something that I'm going to want to remember. So I kind of want to use this as a scenario for the some of the questions that I'm going to have for this podcast. The question is, I want to capture the whole thing. Like I said, how do I start today to better prepare for an upcoming trip?
Yes. Well, there's two schools of thought, and they're both radically opposite. Okay.
So perfect. Here,
first school, prepare as much as you can. Read everything about the location, understand the culture, and get completely in tune to even get the number of the police, make sure that you have everything ready for your insurance. You know where the local hospital is. This is the wise option, option number one.
I don't like it. I already don't like it.
Option number two is what I usually find myself is I know nothing.
Perfect.
And I get lost and I'm just dumped into this scenario. I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. And those are the ones where the magic happens.
Now, good.
I don't want to say one or the other is better, but it often has to do with probably personality types. interestingly, I feel I'm 50-50 left and right brain. So I am very comfortable totally planning out everything perfectly. And I'm also totally comfortable if for whatever reason, I just have no idea what's going on. But I do say that usually my best results are from when I just throw myself into a culture and I'm totally shocked by what I see. And I purposely just get myself lost.
Can you give me an example of why you think that is and when something like that happened?
Yeah. So I guess the excitement and adrenaline, and also, by the way, fear. Okay. I usually couch this by saying that fear in general is not good, but a certain amount of fear actually increases, what would you say? It increases the ability for us to be creative because we have a bit of adrenaline going through our system, and that adrenaline is going to make us hyper sensitive to our environments. And it's almost like way too much coffee.
Yeah.
And you know how we get when we drink too much caffeine. Well, that's very similar when we have no idea what our surroundings are. A little bit of danger is actually something that just spurs creativity to no end. And I'm just super sensitive. I'm looking around. I'm scanning everywhere. Everything is a rectangle for me when I'm looking around. And you would appreciate that too. When you become a photographer, the whole world becomes a rectangle. And this is a good thing because such amazing photos come of it. Now, I will say that if I'm in a very foreign country, then I'll hire a local photographer to help me. So, for example, when I first started to do that was in India, because that is a culture that I knew nothing about. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to be in big trouble. So, and it's really easy to do. You just go to Instagram or Facebook and just find local photographers and just see if they would take you around for a couple hours. And it's just, it's such a time saver. And I really encourage people to do that because you can get so much better photos because you're not, how do I figure out the subway system? Yeah. Well, you don't need to worry about that.
Yeah, that sounds like a really fun idea. That kind of adds to the adventure. Like not only are you going to travel to this new location, but now you just added adventure onto the plate. And that's something that I'm definitely going to incorporate whenever we get off the boat, I believe in, I think it's Cozumel. I'm sure that there's got to be people in Cozumel who will want to be a part of something like that. So I'm excited. Thank you so much for sharing that tip. So now let's go the other way. Okay. We kind of walked into how to just show up and just capture whatever happens in front of your camera. What if we wanted to plan this thing out to the most, you know, tiny detail? When it comes to the photography side of things, what should we be looking for?
Yes, great question. For one thing, for preparation, Instagram is absolutely amazing. So what I do is I look through Instagram with the specific location, and this is very simple. All of us can do it. And so, for example, Cozumel, Mexico. And then you'll see the top hits. Now, half of those top hits are going to be, you know, silly pictures of scantily clad women.
Of course, but, in a tropical location.
Yeah, but the other half are going to be the best photos that people love because they're so beautiful or so intriguing. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want. You just simply, because most of those Instagram images are tagged per location, you know exactly where that photo was taken. This is the best way to plan where you want to photograph. Now, with regards to gear, I have been, over the years, becoming more and more and more of a minimalist. And at this point, I challenge myself. And now I don't think this is wise for everybody, but I have one camera body and one prime lens. That's it. Now, the reason I do this is because I physically want to move in and out of the picture without zooming because I feel that's more of a challenge and it gets my creativity going. And it also allows me to have a small kit. Now, if you're going to a place that's a little bit dangerous, your kit has to be small and unobtrusive. Now, you're a Fujifilm user, I believe.
I am. Absolutely.
So my my kit is the Fujifilm X-Pro2, which is a rangefinder design. and a 35 millimeter equivalent lens. So it would be the 23 millimeter f2. That's pretty much all I use, because most of my work is travel photography. Now, for those who are into other forms of photography, plan on taking, you know, your good zoom lens or whatever. But really keep the package light. You don't want to be a target for thieves. You don't want to have, you know, weighed down shoulders with this huge backpack. And I used to do that, because back in the day, I would have like the Nikon. I think my first pro camera was the D2X. It was a monster camera with huge f2.8 lenses. And really, even though I was younger, I would still get exhausted by the end of the day just by that heavy weight.
Sure.
So when you're planning for trip, pack light. Make sure if you use a tripod that you invest in either, you know, a carbon fiber, or go the other way and just buy a cheap plastic Walmart tripod. Now, people say, why would you ever do that, Mark? Well, interestingly, if you have, if for example, if you're a mirrorless shooter, you're probably going to be using either Sony or a Fujifilm. Those cameras are nice and light. Well, unless you're in a windy environment, you can actually get away with a cheap plastic tripod, and you're going to be able to carry that anywhere because it's so lightweight. Now, of course, you're sacrificing a little bit with the head, because there's no ball head on it. But I'm just wanting to say, keep the kit light, and you're going to be really successful. Also, about what I do whenever I go to a new place, if I'm there for a week, I'm going to rent a local SIM card. I really want to make sure that I have full access to data. And some countries don't allow that, but most do, I think. And it's really a far cheaper option for Canadians. Canadians have the worst and most expensive cell phone packages on the planet, I'm sure. So I always just get a SIM card. It's super quick, super easy, and you don't need voice plan. You just need data. And this will allow you to find those great locations on Google Maps, TripAdvisor, Instagram, and all these other places. And it'll allow you to upload your images as soon as you take them, especially if you're using an iPhone or an Android.
Okay, so there's a lot of things there that I want to unpack. Mm-hmm. One being a mobile workflow, of course, for editing images. But I kind of want to go back to the gear aspect of it, because you said that bringing one camera and one lens is going to result in better photos. Can you tell me why that is? Why is limiting yourself going to create better images?
Yeah, well, I've never golfed before, but I understand that the such thing as a golfer's handicap, where I assume you voluntarily give yourself a handicap in your golf score. I don't even know how that works.
Okay. Yeah, neither do I.
But apparently that sort of levels out the playing field. Well, it's not the same thing in photography, but what I do find is that when I produce or impose a limitation on myself, then I am forced to really step up the creative game. So whenever I go on a trip, I am usually only using one prime lens, and it can either be like a, for example, a 28 millimeter, a 35 millimeter, a 50 millimeter. But whatever lens I choose, I try to stick with that throughout the whole shoot. Now, I will preface this. If I'm photographing for a client, I don't do those things at all.
Sure.
My client is whatever they want, they will get, and I'll take all my lenses. But if it's for me, then this limitation pushes my creative boundaries.
Hey, Raymond here, and we will get back to today's show in just a moment. Do you know what all of the world's top photographers have in common? No, they don't all shoot with the same camera or use the same lens, but they all edit their photos. Now, I'm not talking full digital manipulations, but more subtle visual signatures. That is how you create your own unique style. Are your images living up to their full potential, or do they fall flat? Well, let me help breathe life into your images by giving you 52 of my favorite Lightroom presets absolutely free over at freephotographypresets.com. Again, that is freephotographypresets.com. Don't miss out. Okay, back to today's interview. I love this idea. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I have definitely found that bringing less gear, just like you have found, is much more beneficial to the photographer. It makes it more fun because now suddenly you're not worried about carrying so much gear. But, yeah. But I get a lot of questions from people, at least in the Beginner Photography Podcast Facebook group, saying like, I'm going on this once in a lifetime trip, right? I'm going to Ireland. Okay. And their questions are, you know, I want to bring the DSLR, the lenses, the point and shoots, the drone, the GoPro. I want to bring all these things because they all have their different uses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that still okay to bring these things and not use them? Or would you rather only bring the one camera, the one lens, and say whatever happens, happens? Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com, and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit.
Yeah, so this is what I do is radically strange and it's abnormal. So I would say until you're comfortable with that type of minimalism, go with everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I would hate and feel terrible if someone went on this trip of a lifetime and followed my advice and didn't get that distant eagle because they didn't bring their zoom lens. And another thing is I don't photograph birds. So I'm not going to be taking a long lens. My primary love is street photography and travel photography, which is usually the 35 is perfect.
Yeah. Can you tell me when the gear becomes too much gear?
Yeah. So usually like in the terminology in full frame lingo is your 24 to 70 mm-hmm. and your 70 to 200. Those are the two lenses that are the most common. And those will cover 99.9% of all your work. So if I would suggest that those two lenses are all you need for all travel photography. And if you take more than that, then you're just weighing down your suitcase. That's my assessment. Now, if you're into drones, of course, take it. If you are into GoPro, take it. And all you have to be concerned about with is if you start to get sore shoulders and get grumpy, your creativity is going to suffer. And I know this from firsthand experience, is that if I'm uncomfortable physically because I didn't pack a warm enough jacket or I didn't pack a t-shirt because it's too hot, then I am going to feel very, very uncreative because I'm physically uncomfortable. Now, there's exceptions. War photographers, photojournalists, and, you know, of course we're going to feel uncomfortable. However, most of the time we're on a vacation and it's comfortable. So plan accordingly so you're not weighed down, you have the right amount of clothes. And I always find that if I feel a little bit low emotionally, a good hot meal and a strong espresso really help.
Yeah, in most other countries, the coffee is much better than here in the States for sure. So that's a great tip. That's a great tip. Maybe on my tropical vacation, it'll be something a little bit more refreshing though for the heat.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to talk about, I remember this time, and when I was coming up with the questions for this interview, I was trying to think about vacation photos that I took in the past. Recently, I went out to Arizona to visit my mom. And when I was growing up, she made scrapbooks all the time. And I was going through some of those photos and I realized, you know, how bad these vacation photos were. And it reminded me of this time when I was in fourth grade, when one of my classmates, his name was Irvin, he took a road trip with his family to Mount Rushmore. And when he got back, we all had to sit through a slide presentation of this 9-year-old's photos of like the road and Mount Rushmore. And it was like so far away in these photos that everybody was just bored to tears. So
yes.
What are some signs of amateur travel photography so that we can avoid them and not bore our friends and family?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, because if I can help anybody with this, then the world of slideshow entertainment is going to skyrocket.
Perfect.
Because all of us have sat through, for example, let's say that a friend or a family member goes to Europe and they get 60 photos of the European churches. Well, the churches are beautiful. But after the fifth picture, it's just another boring church.
We get it. Yeah.
So what I advise people to do is to actually hide the primary subject. So in art theory or the lingo of photography, the primary subject is that which is the most visually important. So let's say it's the church. A secondary subject is usually something that supports the primary subject. Now, sometimes a secondary subject could actually frame the primary subject. Let me give you an example. Let's think of that European church. No, let's actually go to the Taj Mahal. Now, everybody photographs the Taj Mahal who goes to India. However, if you only allow a little bit of the Taj Mahal to be viewed, because it's framed with a silhouette of those sort of an area that has arches, or it's hidden partially by a really interesting object on the grounds. Or let's go back to the European church. Maybe only the spire of the church is visible because you've hid it behind other buildings that are out of focus. What we're always trying to do is allow our viewer to have more activation of their imagination. And this is a primary way that we increase the visual value of our photos. So if we think of a snapshot of that European church as a documentary shot, okay, it's okay as it is, no problem. But if we want to go from documentary to fine art, or from documentary to really good travel photography, it's usually the case that we're going to alter the environment to not fully show the subject. So that could be nighttime. Mm-hmm. You could photograph the church at the nighttime where we only see certain elements that are lit up. We could move ourselves so we only capture a small glimpse of the church. Or we could really do something different if we have the drone photographed from an aerial perspective. We're always trying to hide the primary subject to an extent that the imagination of the viewer is activated.
Mm. Okay. This is a really interesting concept. I'm trying to picture it in my head, because if I think of a European church, I have not been to Europe, but I know that they're very large. They're typically in some sort of square with lots of space around. So how is hiding the photo? I understand that it's adding adding a portion of the viewer's imagination, right? Like for them to explore that, to enjoy the photo. How much of this should we be doing? How much should we be hiding?
I understand.
Go ahead.
What I try to do myself, like say, for example, we have the beautiful church and we have two trees that are going to frame up the spire really nicely. Those trees are acting as what we'd call a foreground element. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the trees are hiding the church, but we still see 20 or 30% of the church surface.
Okay.
It's just that we don't see the whole church. And these trees are framing devices, or like I said, the foreground element. And whenever we can have foreground elements or framing devices that package our subject together, we actually produce a more visually appealing image. Think of fashion photography or car photography. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever we see a new picture of a Lamborghini or maybe a McLaren, these are beautiful works of art. I guarantee you that you will not see every element of the car. Car photographers are brilliant. They will photograph and light this beautiful car so that you're only seeing about 30 or 40% of the surface area. The rest is black. Mm-hmm. It's all in carefully arranged shadows. And you see these beautiful lights and really low to the ground. The imagination has to kick in somewhere. And whenever we see a full image of the primary subject, we run the risk of losing interest in the viewer. If we hide some parts of the primary subject because of unique use of shadow or foreground elements or framing, it's incredible how much more visual value that image has because the viewer's imagination is engaged. What is the one thing that we want our viewers to do when they see our photos?
Say, wow, that's a beautiful photo.
Or a disturbing photo or an interesting photo or
sure.
any type of emotion. But we
have a reaction,
to,
yes.
We have to have a reaction. Now, one of the great ways in getting that reaction is by providing mystery, confusion, drama, metaphor, narrative. These are all devices that we as photographers really need to infuse in our images to take our images from just a standard snapshot into a work of art.
Hey, Raymond here, and I know that diving into the world of editing can feel like navigating a maze, especially if you're just starting out. So that's why I created our exclusive collection of 52 Lightroom presets, absolutely free. While presets can dramatically enhance your photos, they're not a one-click solution. They're a starting point for your creativity and an opportunity to learn and grow in your editing skills. These presets work seamlessly with all versions of Lightroom, whether you're on a computer or using Lightroom Mobile. And they're designed to simplify your editing process, adding that professional touch to your photos while giving you the flexibility to fine-tune them to your taste. So if you're ready to take your photos to the next level, head over to freephotographypresets.com right now and get editing today. Okay, let me think about this. I love this idea, adding I guess we're not adding more context to the photo. We're adding just more intrigue when we do these things to add that interest. So if we are on a family vacation, okay, yep. We're thinking of, you know, Europe, we go to these nice places, we want to show off specific things. Mm-hmm. These things are great. If we're in a family atmosphere around yep. other people, what sorts of things can we be doing to add that intrigue and interest?
Yeah. So that's a great question. Now, family shots... Like, for example, I have two systems. I shoot with an iPhone and also, of course, my Fuji. And if it's just a standard snapshot that I'm not really caring about anything deep, no narrative, no metaphor, no poetry, then just a standard snapshot of my friends and my family in front of that church is perfectly fine. However, mm-hmm. If I have the time, then I'll do fun stuff like forced perspective with my kids. They love doing that. Have you ever seen that where one of the kids is holding on to the church steeple? Well, the church steeple is
right.
is maybe, who knows, 60 feet high, but there mm-hmm. she is holding on to the top. These are fun things that will take our potentially boring family snapshots and allowing them to be appealing to both this generation and future generations down the road. Another thing is when you're photographing with your family and you're in these wonderful spots, well, try scale. Like try to have your son or your daughter or your mom or your dad so small in the picture that they are dwarfed by the sheer scale of the massive Colosseum or the, mm-hmm. you know, the huge church or whatever. Essentially, or change your angle. Essentially, we're always trying to avoid the elevation that 99% of all photography is taken. Here's a quiz for you. What height in feet, because you're American, what height in feet are 99% of all photos taken?
Like 5'7", like eye level.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Whatever the average height of people are, that is the normal height of all photography. Mm-hmm. So if we want to get into the 1%, what do we have to do?
We either go up or we either go down.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that is the key. And why do you feel that not many people take those low shots from the ground shooting up, which are always very interesting?
Just because it's a little bit more work.
Exactly. It's because it's uncomfortable.
Okay.
Yeah, to get down on your knees. And, you know, it's not comfortable to do that. That's why everyone avoids it. But if we, as photographers, want to really instill interesting elements into our images, we have to do things like, you know, put our hand up really high to photograph shooting down, or to get really low and to shoot from a lower perspective, which actually empowers our primary subject. So if it's a person, it makes them appear grander and more important. And that's a good thing. Luckily, with newer cameras, we actually have flip screens where we can actually get those low shots comfortably because we can just look down. My camera doesn't have that, but most of the newers do. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I was out with the kids yesterday, and I was doing just that. There was like this field. It's finally like a nice day outside. It was like this field, and I just loved like the moving clouds. I also shoot with an X-Pro too. I brought the camera down as low as I could. It being bright, you can't really see it. So then I had to lay in the grass. It was raining the day before yesterday. I got all muddy. But a flip screen would be a great thing to have. For sure. So just adding that different visual interest just by simply changing the height of the camera. That's a very good tip. I love that right there. I have a pair of friends right now, my wife's friends. They are in Cuba. They just went to Cuba. They went to go visit it. They're super excited. Every single photo that they've posted on Facebook or Instagram is them in front of something. Them in front of a sign that says "Welcome to Cuba." Them in front of a storefront. Them in front of like the beach and stuff like that. Now these shots are fine for them because they are snapshots, right? But when I go out with my family, that's what everybody says. Oh, let me get a photo in front of this thing. Let me get a photo in front. Like, I want to be in this photo of this thing. And then all the photos start to look exactly the same. But like, I don't want to take those photos. I want photos that have mood, that have that feel, that have culture, that get the whole experience, right?
Yeah.
Aside from snapshots, what specific photos should I be hunting for?
Yeah, great question. And first of all, there is a place for selfie photos, but it's only about a 10% place or 5%. And after a while, it just becomes silly. Now, I know that influencers are a separate breed and they have to, that's their job, and that's okay. But for the most of us who are not, selling our using our face to provide an income, then maybe 5 or 10% selfies is a good ratio. After that, we want to actually create images that mean something to someone else. I'll give you an example. If we don't create value for our viewer is going to walk away. Mm. Now, you and I are not superstar status with regards to. We're not supermodels. Okay.
Yeah.
I certainly am not. So
that was a very diplomatic way of putting it. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So that means that if I go beyond my 5% or 10% of including me in the shot in Japan or whatever, then I'm no longer providing value to my viewer. My viewer receives value by having clear and concise content. Explaining the photo, maybe giving some photo lessons under that photo, but that photo needs to speak to them. That's how I give value to my client. Now, how do you, of course, get a photo to speak to someone? Well, in many ways, we've already been talking about it. It's creating images that will allow people to linger on your photo longer than all the other photos. Mm-hmm. How many photos do you think we go through a day?
How many photos do we take or how many photos do we see?
No, just by viewing.
Oh,
Instagram,
hundreds.
Facebook, websites. We flip hundreds. Through hundreds and hundreds. And why do you stop flipping through at that one picture? Why do you stop there?
There's just something interesting in the photo, whether it be
it grabs you. Yes.
The light or the subject matter.
Exactly. Now, this subject matter can be pretty much anything. We're not limited to the far-off exotic vacation. It could be in your own hometown or even in your house. It is something that is photographed or recorded in a unique way that very few other people have done. Now, this does not mean that you're up the creek if you live in what you think is a boring environment. That's not true. Mm-hmm. There's always a photo to be taken. It just takes you getting in your practice, you know, maybe doing a photo a day challenge for 365, but getting the sort of engine going where you realize that there is a photo here in my environment and I'm going to give myself the challenge to do one a day and make it look interesting. Now, with regards to back to Cuba, my goodness, Cuba would be so rich visually that, you know, photographing those wonderful old cars, but instead of just taking a picture of a classic Studebaker or whatever cars they had over there, why not take the time to kneel down, get really low, and photograph the car from the ground perspective? Because if you do that, automatically you're in the 1%. And all of the other tourists that go through Cuba have taken that same Studebaker, but they've taken it at 5'6". Am I right?
Yeah.
But that's going to be the same as everyone else. So what you want is to get down on the ground, make sure that car looks grand and amazing. And you can do that easily just by moving your position to a lower scenario.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So about things that are, you know, things, not people.
Yep.
How do we give them more feeling aside from just like bringing the camera up and down? How do we give them more life?
Oh, I love that question. Have you ever heard of the Buena Vista Social Club?
The Buena Vista Social Club. I feel like I have, but please remind me.
Yeah. So Wim Wenders did a film on these Cuban musicians. And this was probably in the 90s, if I recall. And it was just about the director wanting to find out if they were still alive, because they were amazing musicians, I think maybe in the 50s or the 60s, if I get my story straight. And anyway, the desire was to find them and bring them to New York City for a reunion concert. You have to see that movie. It's amazing. It's called The Buena Vista Social Club. Anyway, the cover shot was one of the most inspiring photos I've ever seen. And it's a cover shot of a classic vehicle in a Cuban street in Havana. And it was saturated colors. It was shot in film, obviously. But the amount of shadow was so deep. And I said, I've never seen a photo so dramatic and that grabbed my soul as much as this one. And one of the musicians was walking up the Havana street alongside the car. Half the shot was in deep shadow. Why am I saying this? Almost always I reduce the blacks in my photo. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? For those who are not familiar with editing, in your editing software, you will have a slider that usually has, it says either shadow or dark or black, or sometimes both. For example, in Lightroom, you have shadows and you have blacks as separate. If you reduce those blacks or those shadows, you're immediately increasing the drama and the visual value of your photo. And it's the easiest thing to do in the world. That's all you have to do.
That's a great tip.
And that just punches the picture. And it's amazing at what kind of return you'll get on your investment of literally 3 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I'm definitely going to post the poster for the Buena Vista Social Club in the show notes. So if anybody's listening right now, check out the show notes and you'll be able to see it there as an example. So let's now, this is a perfect segue. Let's talk about your mobile editing workflow. If you are in these locations, right? Are you, again, let's take the vacation example. Are you also bringing your laptop, your card reader, backup hard drives? Are you bringing it all, or is it all on your phone or something in between?
Yeah. So this is very exciting. I'm glad you asked this because I have finally, about a year ago, discovered and created a workflow where I don't need my computer. All I need is my iPhone. I can do a complete professional photo shoot in a different country with my camera and just this, using Lightroom CC. Now, for those who have not got into Lightroom, there are currently two versions. One's called Lightroom Classic, and one's called Lightroom CC, and I advise newer photographers to jump into Lightroom CC. It's a cloud-based system, and it allows you to be completely mobile and edit anywhere in the world off of your phone. Now, you may say, well, Mark, that's not professional. You can never do a professional edit on your phone. Anyway, I'd like to challenge you if you believe that, because I have been doing experiments with Lightroom CC ever since it was invented, which was only about a year ago, I think. Anyway, as soon as it came out, I said, I'm going to push myself, because I'm a travel photographer, to see if I can do an entire professional photo shoot just with this. So I've got my Fuji, load my Fuji images into here, then Lightroom CC app pulls the images in, and amazingly, this is the first time I've seen it, but the Lightroom CC, I guess you call it an engine, has the exact same abilities as your laptop version, because usually an app has is a dumbed down version of whatever app is on your laptop, right?
Right.
But because this is all cloud-based, the actual processing of Lightroom CC images is not really done in your iPhone, and it's not even really done in your MacBook or your Windows computer. All of the processing of your raw images is done in the cloud somewhere under the underground in California in some bunker that Adobe has kept safe. So, for example, also on our Lightroom for iPhone or Android, you can take raw photos with the app. You take a raw photo, well, it goes up to the cloud, lives sort of in the servers as a raw image. And when we do edits, like 2 weeks from now, I do an edit, well, it's just an instruction going up to Adobe. It's not really the photo being edited. And that's why this system, I think, is great, because it doesn't require a huge amount of data transfer. So if I want to edit a full raw image, 24 megapixel from my X-Pro2, it's super fast, because when I make my edits, like say I want to adjust the contrast, well, it's just a little instruction going up to the cloud saying, Mark Hemmings says adjust contrast. That's it. It's so easy. Anyway.
It's that easy.
I am really excited about the Lightroom CC workflow, and it allows us as photographers to travel. You can be on a ski hill going up on your ski lift and still edit raw files and send them to your client.
So now suddenly, if it's all cloud-based, not only do you have the phone instead of the computer, but now you don't need the external hard drive, since it's all being backed up to the cloud. Is that right?
That's correct. But very cool. For those who are still nervous, and I'm by the way, I have 3 copies of everything everywhere. Lightroom CC, just the same as Lightroom Classic, allows for you to just plug in an external hard drive to your computer, and it'll back up instantly every time you make a change. So it's you have the physical hard drive backup, you have the cloud backup, and if you are completely anal about backups like I am, you know, that Lightroom backup that you just plugged in, make a copy of it, mm-hmm. put it in a safety deposit box, send it to your brother's house. There's no way for you to lose, you know, your collection in this day and age.
So let me ask you a kind of a technical question here, because I've just kind of started to get into this with an iPad instead of my phone. When it comes to culling photos, that is where I have the most difficulty, because on a computer, I'm used to Photo Mechanic cull through thousands of images in like 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. What's the best way that you have found to cull through images? Do you upload all of the photos that you take into Lightroom, cull from there, or do you do it through the Photos app?
It's a fantastic idea, question. And there's two schools of thought, as always. When I plug in my SD card to my computer, if I'm going to be working through my laptop, then I have the choice. Lightroom gives me the choice to check mark only the ones I want. Mm-hmm. However, I'll be honest, I just upload them all, entire card, because I find it more enjoyable to sit in a cafe, listen, you know, the cool environment, drink an espresso, and then call the photos in a place where I am in my happy place.
Okay.
I don't really like to pre-select images to import into Lightroom right off my SD card, because I find that I'm not in it's not a creative scenario, right?
Right.
I load them all. My whole SD card gets loaded. And then I just sit back, relax, and cull. Now, the culling process in Lightroom that I do is I just press X on it. It's okay. You can't see my laptop here, obviously, but I press X and the next arrow. X, next arrow. Oh, I like that one. Next arrow. Next, X, X. And this is a really quick way just to delete 100 photos. Now, the X does not delete the photo, but it flags it as to be deleted.
Right. I gotcha. Okay. Yeah. And then, so essentially on your phone, it's same. The same thing minus the keyboard shortcut. You just choose the flagged images or the reject images.
And interestingly, on the phone, it's even easier, because all you have to do is just go zip like that, like a down
swipe
and
down.
Then you'll swipe down and you'll see the X flag. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Just flip.
Perfect.
So they made it easy.
Okay, so now we've talked about going out, we've talked about planning our trip, we've talked about going out and how to make photos more interesting, we talked about what gear we should be using, and even the mobile workflow. Now we have our photos. The trip is over. Here they are. Here's 100 photos or so. What do we do with them?
Yeah, so what I love to do first is make sure that my blacks are the way I want them. Mm-hmm. So as I said, and I strongly advise all of your listeners to try this, is that if you feel that your images lack a little bit of drama or a little bit of punch, they're well exposed, okay? The exposure's fine, but you just want that little bit more punch, then go to the blacks and reduce it just a bit until you feel that you have what you need. Again, if you don't see that word blacks, look for the word shadows or look for the word dark or something like that.
I gotcha. And I want to cut you off real quick. I apologize. I totally screwed up that question. Where I was going with it was, we have the finished photos.
Yes.
What do we do at that point? Are we sharing them on social media? Are we turning them into a video slideshow? Are we making a book? What do we do? How do we preserve these memories?
Yeah. So when I have gone through my images, I daily send images to my Instagram and Facebook. So that's the priority. And what I do after I edit the picture and I really like it the way it is, then I usually use my phone because I find it quicker. All I do is go to the up arrow on that image within Lightroom CC and send it straight to Facebook or Instagram.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Now, there's another way. You could send it to your photos collection, either an Android or iPhone, and do it that way as well. There's a couple ways to get them online. Now, I don't print mine out so much unless I have a need. It's usually social based, because that's where most of my viewers are. And I usually add a free photo instruction on every photo.
Oh, cool. Like how the photo was taken.
Yeah, and also ways that you can create a similar image. So, awesome. For example, I think you'll be putting my Instagram
link. In the show notes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you go there, you have a history, and you have an entire photography course just through the images alone, because I always put little lessons on them.
That is a very cool idea. That is a very cool idea. Definitely something that people are going to have to check out. Absolutely, for sure. Mark, you've been to a lot of locations. I want to know, is there one like hidden treasure location that you have, a place that maybe really surprised you? When you showed up, you were just kind of blown away.
Yes, I'm glad you asked that as well. The craziest place I've ever been to, and when I say crazy, it's crazy in the best possible way for photography, is Jerusalem.
Really?
I have never been. I was shocked. Jerusalem is not even, now I'm not sure in miles, but in square kilometers, it's not even 2 square kilometers.
Very small.
Yet, that's sort of like the center of the world. It's this is the place where the 3 monotheistic religions started. So you have Arabs in their white garments. You have the Jewish priests with the big hats. You have the Christian priests with their long flowing black robes. And they're all walking around. It's like, am I in the Twilight Zone? Or am I in, you know, some fabricated tourism village? No. This is the real thing. I've never seen the real thing to the extent that I've seen in Jerusalem. I think every photographer should go there. I have some images on my website that show Jerusalem. It is insanely interesting for photography.
Sounds like I know where one of your next workshops is going to be.
I would love to do that.
I got one last question for you. I know that we've been chatting for a while. I want to be conscious of your time. I got one last question for you. And I love asking this question. Have you ever had an embarrassing moment on the job? But have you ever had an embarrassing moment while photographing another culture abroad?
I think so. I have a passable understanding of Japanese because I've been there a lot. It's certainly enough to chat with a cab driver, but it's not, I can't get into any deep conversations. there's a wonderful dessert in Japan called mochi, and that's pounded rice. And in the middle is a bean paste, a sweet bean paste called anko. And, I said to a Japanese person, "Kore wa oishii anko desu," meaning this is delicious anko paste. And they burst out laughing, and they said, "Eventually, you just said that this is delicious excrement."
Oh, geez.
I was going to say a different word, but the irony is that anko paste is brown and kind of looks like diarrhea.
Did they think that you were confused for a second and that you were just going to go for it?
They knew I was a silly foreigner learning their language.
And that is too funny.
It was a very cute experience. Anko and anko. Who knew?
Very similar. In fact, you just saying them to me, I couldn't distinguish a difference even if I tried. So
yes.
Sounds like a reasonable mistake. Well, Mark, I want to thank you. You have shared so much knowledge. You've helped me out a lot in preparing for my trip this coming fall. I'm probably going to do a little bit of planning, maybe not a whole bunch, but maybe I'll kind of venture into that space and do some planning. And also, I think I'm going to give the iPad workflow a stronger look because I think that would obviously free up a whole bunch of stuff. So, Mark, again, you shared a ton of great information. I really appreciate it. And I know that the listeners did as well. So before I let you go, can you let everybody know where they can find you online?
Yes, by all means. So if they want free photography lessons each day, Instagram at Mark Hemmings. And that's MARKHEMMINGS. And also to see my whole collection of images, markhemmings.com is my website. And if you're a Facebook user, it's facebook.com Mark Hemmings Photography. Make sure the photography is at the end, because the Mark Hemmings is my personal one, but the photography is the one where I share all my images with the free photography lessons.
So cool. So cool. Well, Mark, again, thank you so much for coming on. Yes. And I look forward to keeping up with you, your travels, and even your photo lessons. So again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Okay. Have fun in Cozumel.
Thank you for listening to today's interview from the Beginner Photography Podcast Vault. You know, personally, I would love to hear what you took away from this interview. What are you going to implement into your photography that you learned today? Feel free to share what it is and join the conversation in the Beginner Photography Podcast Facebook community. You can find the community by searching Facebook for Beginner Photography Podcast, or if you're driving, there is a link to the group on the homepage at beginnerphotographypodcast.com. Head over there, click the link, and join the Facebook community today. Until next week, remember, the more you shoot today, the better you will be tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.